From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1979, when a group of people, including a woman named Phyllis Korn, helped found a nonprofit organization in Rochester to address an issue that was often hidden in the shadows, something that was generally considered a so-called private family matter. I'm talking about domestic violence. Korn wanted to bring the matter to light and help people affected by domestic violence find safety and healing. On July 9th, 1979, it was the opening of Alternatives for Battered Women, the third domestic violence shelter in New York State at the time. Over the last 40 years, Alternatives for Battered Women, renamed Willow Domestic Violence Center in 2015, has been at the forefront of the domestic violence movement and the education movement, not only in Rochester, but nationally as well. Each year, it supports more than 7,000 people in Monroe County. While 90% of them are women and children, Willow also provides services to men in the LGBTQ community. This hour, we're talking about how the domestic violence movement has changed over the last 40 years. Our guests represent Alternatives for Battered Women and Willow at different stages in its evolution. We're also discussing why rates of domestic violence are so high in our community, higher here than in much of the rest of New York State. Is that due to greater awareness, better reporting, victims more comfortable coming forward, or a higher prevalence? It's a conversation about how to put survivors first. I'd like to welcome our guest this hour. The current president and CEO of Willow is Megan DeChateauvieux, who's back with us. It's great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
It's an honor to have Phyllis Korn here, former executive director of Alternatives for Battered Women. Great to have you. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
And also with us is Vincent Butler, a social worker who worked with Alternatives for Battered Women and founder of the Men's Education for Nonviolence and Abuse Workshop. Welcome to you. Thanks for being
here. Thank you. Good morning.
Well, Phyllis, we go back 40 years. Why don't you tell me a little bit about what the landscape around domestic violence looked like and what you remember about the founding of the program? What was happening at the time?
Well, Evan, let me just back up for one moment. It started well before I was ever part of it.
You never want any credit.
He's learned.
I have learned. I have been told about you. But go ahead.
There is a quote that I love. Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. Margaret Mead said that and applies to the very courageous people who came before me, who laid the groundwork for the day that we opened the door of our first shelter.
And so at the time, when we talked about domestic violence, was it often referred to as just a private family matter, something to, you know, a private issue between couples, things like that?
Mm-hmm, yep. Absolutely. Other people weren't supposed to butt in. No one was.
None of our business.
No, nobody is supposed to know about this. We keep it under this. You know, we just don't talk about it. But that was the norm, and also the attitudes. In those days, the man's home was his castle. Boys will be boys. Everyone colluded with the abuser, and it was an enormously difficult pattern to change.
Yeah, a pattern to change behavior, but also the cultural idea that we can talk about this, that victims can mm-hmm. come forward. What do you recall being the biggest mountain to move in that? What was the hardest part about making this change?
I think it was how very many people had to be impacted before there could be real social change. I think we set about making a difference because we wanted to talk to law enforcement. We wanted to talk to teachers, to ministers, to doctors and nurses, to everyone. Our goal was get the word out there. And I think we did it from the minute we opened our eyes in the morning till we went to bed at night.
What did law enforcement say at the time, late 1970s, and you said, we've got to start investigating this more. We have to pursue this.
We met some pretty cold shoulders. We talked to a lot of police chiefs and, you know, their officers, and there were a lot of silent laughs in the background, but they were by and large not terribly supportive.
Were there any single incidents, cases, or moments that you felt like this is a change moment in this community? Now things are turning. Or was it sort of a slow build?
I think it was a build. Mm-hmm. I really think it was a slow build. We had so many places. And what I'm saying is not absolute. It certainly was not all of law enforcement. There were some very sympathetic officers as well as those who snickered behind our backs.
I think for someone maybe of, not to date ourselves, my generation, because I was born in 1979. so was Willow. See, look, we share a birthday. But, you know, for me in my adulthood, the notion that usually men, but not always, but a man could beat his wife, that a man could attack his wife, and that there would not be consequences, it's hard for me to get my head around that. Mm-hmm. But in the late 1970s, if we would have asked the direct question, can a man lay hands on his wife? And the answer, I guess, was
he could.
Was
under
yes.
The right circumstances, he absolutely could. And frequently, nobody else would ever know. And when the officers were called, the response usually was to tell the guy to take a walk around the house mm-hmm. Around the block so she could leave quietly.
I imagine now it's a very different landscape, and we're going to talk about that this hour, for victims to come forward, and still very difficult, and probably always will be. I mean, nobody gets into a relationship because they expect or want to be abused. But I cannot imagine what it was like in those early days, trying to convince people, yes, you can come talk about this. Yes, there are services. Yes, we can seek an investigation and pressing charges. I mean, what was that like?
Almost unheard of. Yeah. The laws had to change, and they did. They began changing. But there are so many forms of abuse. It is so insidious. It is so multifaceted. Everything from the financial and emotional and the things that nobody else sees to the woman who comes to work or goes to the doctor's office and has a big bruise under her eye and nobody asks how she got it.
Yeah, that's another thing. I mean, the physical signs of abuse, was the sort of the cultural reaction, was it to ignore it if usually a woman shows up at work or in a social situation with a black eye, bruises, et cetera. And did she often feel compelled to try to kind of cover up or deflect on that?
Yeah. Oh, she would cover it up with makeup, or she simply wouldn't show. She simply wouldn't be where people expected her to be, where she was in the public eye at all. She'd stay home.
I should be careful, by the way, Megan, to shant of you in sort of framing this as if that doesn't happen at all. I mean, that certainly still does happen. But what goes through your mind in hearing what it was like in the late 70s versus the work you're doing now as the CEO of Willow?
It's incredible to hear, to put it in perspective, about the barriers that we see that we're facing that we feel are insurmountable now, and yet what you have overcome and with the community support and building these coalitions and so many incredible agencies. Just listening to Phyllis talk about this is so heartwarming and inspirational, as we do face so many barriers still for survivors to come forward seeking support. So there have been many legislative changes over the years. This past session, they pushed forward 40 bills that addressed all these slight ways, as you say, the insidious ways that abuse shows itself in the world, and ways to support survivors as they come forward. We have a lot of work to do, but there's been so much. We're standing on the shoulders of giants.
Next Friday, Willow's 40th anniversary gala is going to be a celebration of sorts. I mean, it's a celebration of the progress and the work that's being done, but it's also a way of honoring 40 years. That's why I'm sort of careful about that term. I mean, nobody wants to celebrate the fact that you need to exist, but mm-hmm. our community needs you. So next Friday, I should say, it's Willow's 40th anniversary gala. And I don't even know if you have any tickets left. I mean, the event is at the Hyatt Regency.
Tickets are going fast. We have a few left, but they are going really fast. We have so many incredible supporters in the community and people who want to be there with us. And I think it's fair to say it's a celebration of the many successes over the years, and I like to think of it as a celebration of the strength and resilience of survivors. Those people that we see who come through our doors have endured so much, and they are incredible to have been through what they've been through, and then to continue working to keep themselves and their families safe.
And it's willowcenterny.org. That's the website if you want tickets.
Yes.
And we're not just saying this, even though I will happen to be there next Friday, but we're not just saying this when you say tickets are going fast. In fact, Megan said before the hour began, I'm not even sure there's tickets left, but there's probably a few. WillowCenterNY.org for their 40th anniversary gala, which is next Friday, if you want to attend. And I know they'd love to see you if you can still get tickets before they are gone. Now, Vincent Butler, you were someone who kind of came in at a time where, boy, more than ever, I think, when we talk about changing the culture, it's changing the culture of expectation of what power is in relationships, what men expect in terms of having power in relationships. And you founded the Men's Education for Nonviolence and Abuse Workshop. When was that?
That was in 1981. I started that at the request of Phyllis. One of the things I learned early in my career is you don't say no to Phyllis. So not only is she very humble, she has a way of convincing people to do things that they didn't think they were going to be able to do. And because my relationship with Phyllis started before that in terms of having provided the first support group for battered women in the city at Genesee Mental Health Center at Genesee Hospital. But you're right, that was a major task to take on, to go against the grain of patriarchy and control and ownership of women. And many men that came through the program said, what are you talking about? She's my wife. My meaning I own her and I can do what I want to do with my possessions.
So what did you try to teach them and how did that go?
Well, it was never a dull day, I can tell you that. What we tried to do is, again, gently teach the men, give them something different to think about, change their perspective. We didn't try to get them to get it, because if we tried that, we would be doing to them what they would be doing to their partners. So we would use, sometimes depend on something, report that might be in the news, there might be a movie clip it that we would use to start a discussion. And to also, our major focus that seemed to help quite a bit was focusing on the effect of domestic violence on children. And that was a major hook to get men to pay attention. Because many of the men, if you start talking about their kids, they start listening up, and they did not want to harm their kids. And so part of the lesson was, you are harming your kids by creating this fear in your home and in the relationship in the family through your controlling and abusive actions.
Have you seen the kind of change that you hoped in 1981 that you would see?
Honestly, no. I think that we would have liked to see a lot more change going on. I wish that the men's workshop went out of business because they didn't need us anymore. Unfortunately, the program ended because there was lack of mandates. So, and as we continue to pick up the paper every day, almost every day, there is some type of domestic violence being reported. So that is something that we are very disappointed at. I'm disappointed at that, and our community continues to be disappointed at that.
We also, just to jump in, we have a really great collaboration in the community, and there are incredible programs working on all sides of this issue. We recently learned that our local offender accountability funds were lost. So there was a program running for offenders, and it recently was shut down
right.
at Delphi.
Right.
So this is a piece that someone could pick up and carry.
Mm-hmm. Offenders accountability?
Offender accountability.
How did that work?
Well, it was a 26-week program where the offender, it was based on gender group, so they were mostly men in this group, would participate and similar to what Vinny's saying, just kind of explore the different ways they could have handled the situation, to think about their families differently, and to, you know, do a little bit of group therapy, really, and moving them into a different space and how they think about their relationships.
Mm-hmm. And accountability was an important piece to get men to understand that they're responsible for their behavior, that she didn't make me hit her, that she didn't do this and she didn't do that. And when men were truthful, they admitted things like, I don't have an anger problem. Anger is a tool that I use to control my partner. And so that was also a very important piece.
Do we now have enough evidence to say that offenders are reformable?
Research is very difficult in the domestic violence field, especially on offenders. Who do you safely ask, is this working? Many offenders are going to not answer the question truthfully. If you ask their partner, you're putting their current or former partner in danger by asking that question, because that the offender feels that information will go back to his parole officer, probation officer, or judge that would then create a more intense sentence. So it's interesting when you talk about research, not many researchers have to worry about, is my questioning going to put people at further danger?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Phyllis, well, you kind of, when I asked Vincent that question, you had an interesting reaction. You kind of shrugged and laughed a little. Are offenders reformable?
I think the jury maybe is out on that question. There has to be a great determination for somebody to change the way they're thinking and reacting. And sometimes it takes a social club to hit them over the head with.
In a nonviolent way.
How about you, Megan? Do you think they're reformable?
I do. I think it depends on the level of lethality or danger in the situation or the particular abuser. The offender accountability programs deal with those who have had a significant felony level offense. And so it's something that we've been trying to do at Willow is to break the silence around the many different types of abuse and the many levels of abuse. And so there are so many in our community who are experiencing relationship abuse, intimate partner violence that does not get to the level, escalate to the level of a felony offense, and yet so many people are enduring this in our community. I was going to say the bigger opportunity for us as we're getting into this land of offender accountability, the bigger opportunity is to go upstream. And if we can engage our young people before this abusive behavior starts, I think we have a chance to really shift the culture. And so prevention is really key to all the work that we're doing. We have had in the workshops we do in high schools, we have had students come forward forever. Every time we've gone into a classroom, students will come forward and say, I'm experiencing this. This is happening in my home. This is happening to me. My girlfriend or boyfriend or partner is doing this to me. We've seen something different happening over the last year and a half or so, where students are coming forward and saying, wow, I didn't realize that was abusive. I'm doing this to my partner and I need to stop. I just got chills even saying that. But these young people are coming forward and saying, wow, texting my girlfriend 500 times in the morning and demanding she take a picture of who she's with so she's not with that boy is abuse. Well, yes, that is.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Phyllis. Yeah.
I think if there's any basis for hope that I have at all, it's the young people. It's changing their attitudes and catching them when they're preteen. And helping them see what abuse is all about.
And what healthy relationships are.
What healthy relationships are.
And how to teach that and when to start. And yet, when I asked Vincent Butler if he has seen in 38 years since the launch of these men's education programs the kind of change he hoped for, and he said no. You know, frankly, Vincent, I thought of an event that happened just a few days ago, and it's now a firestorm in the news as the World Series starts. And I want to tell a little story here that I think illustrates why we still have so far to go here. So there is a major league pitcher named Antonio Osuna, and he's a very good pitcher. He was a closer for the Toronto Blue Jays. Now, he allegedly assaulted the mother of his then 3-year-old child in May of last year. Her name's Alejandra Roman Cota. I say allegedly because prosecutors dropped the charges after she returned to Mexico and said she would not testify. However, as part of the bargain that Osuna made with the league, he agreed not to have contact with her for 1 year, and Major League Baseball decided to suspend him for 75 games, but that was a regular season suspension, not postseason. So the Houston Astros decided they were going to pick him up. He's a talented guy. He'll serve a suspension and he'll pitch. And now he's pitching. And he pitched the other night in their clinching game. In fact, he gave up a 2-run home run in the 9th inning that allowed the New York Yankees to tie that game, and then the Astros went on to win. And so the Astros are in the World Series. So they're celebrating in the clubhouse. The team is. You know, they're spraying champagne everywhere. And this is more than an hour after the game ends. Party's still going on. And all of a sudden, in the center of the clubhouse, the assistant general manager of the Astros, his name is Brandon Taubman, he turned to a group of three female reporters. And I want to quote Stephanie Apstein's reporting for Sports Illustrated. Stephanie was there in the clubhouse. Taubman turned to a group of three female reporters, including one wearing a purple domestic violence awareness bracelet, and yelled half a dozen times, "Thank God we got Osuna. I'm so blanking glad we got Osuna." Over and over. The outburst was offensive and frightening enough that another Houston staff member had to apologize. The Astros at the time declined to comment, and they also declined to make Taubman available for an interview. That is from Stephanie Apstein, reporting for Sports Illustrated. And then the Astros followed up with this statement. Quote, "The story posted by Sports Illustrated is misleading and completely irresponsible. Brandon Taubman's comments had everything to do about the game situation that just occurred and nothing else. They were also not directed toward any specific reporters. We are extremely disappointed in Sports Illustrated's attempt to fabricate a story where one does not exist," end quote. What they're actually saying there is our general manager was just trying to console Antonio Osuna because he gave up a home run in this game and wanted him to feel better. In the midst, by the way, of them drinking champagne and smoking cigars and going to the World Series, and he decided to do that, he needed to shout expletives at reporters about how happy they were to have this guy. And it just happened to include three women who were reporting. What do you think, Vincent?
Well, that's a classic example of minimizing, denying, and blaming. It's a tactic that abusers historically use and institutions use. And in looking at how do we change the culture and the thinking, it has to be a community response to that. And so Major League Baseball is part of the community, and they have to work on
absolutely
their issues,
right,
as does the NFL, and as does the community of Rochester. So you really can't expect a program to change people's thinking. You need a community. So this is one of the things that it sounds like the Houston Astros organization needs to continue to review and work at.
Oh, my gosh. You know what? The entire thing was pathetic. Starting with Brandon Taubman, starting with the fact that this team is so excited to have a player on their team who can help them, even if he happens to be an abuser who had no consequences for his actions. And the New York Yankees have their own issues with Aroldis Chapman, as do many, many teams. It was pathetic. But then for the Astros to minimize or deny this, and now, by the way, it's not just Stephanie Apstein. There are other reporters who are in the locker room confirming her account of these actions. But here's what I see, Phil. It's 40 years after you did all this work to found this, and society has ostensibly changed. Our society still prizes someone who can be a productive performer for an organization, even if they happen to be an abuser of women. As long as they can help the bottom line or help you win, the consequences will be minimized and they will be protected. That's what I learned from the Houston Astros today. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is. It's collusion with the abusers. There's a society that does not want to look at this, does not want to see. As Vince said, it's so pervasive. It's every level of our society. It exists, and people want to close their eyes to it. They do not want to see it.
And Megan DeChateauvieux, I should also say, to be fair, as a journalist, I don't know what Antonio Osuna or Aroldis Chapman or other players who are still getting paid millions of dollars have done privately to make amends or to try to make amends. I don't necessarily buy that they've done very much, to be honest with you, but I don't know. What do you make of this incident in Houston?
I'm not sure if that piece of it actually matters.
Okay, that's fair.
I mean, that's great if they have done something privately to make amends, but their particular piece of it isn't what concerns me. It's more about the people in power in the situation who are complicit in silencing the victims and reinforcing and colluding with, as you say, the abusers. And so the idea that you would have someone questioning this, the leadership of that team would come out and full force stand behind this person in the way that they did. that very aggressive yelling too, I think just it shows a social fraying of our social fabric, right? And the ways that this kind of behavior is excused and perpetuated, even in the very defense of the player, the way that he acted was aggressive and abusive toward the reporters, male or female. And it's the way that we talk to each other has eroded and become okay to have these emotional outbursts that are full of anger.
And mm-hmm. the amazing thing to me is as someone who often works with people in public relations, mm-hmm. usually in 2019, what will happen is an incident like that, then a day or two later, the report comes out and there's time to digest it. And a PR department will construct some sort of a statement apologizing and seeking to sort of deflect a little bit. This claim that this is fake news from the Houston Astros, I couldn't believe it. Mm-hmm. You know, these are three women reporters and plenty of other eyewitnesses. And look at the power structure. I don't see enough change there. I'm just saying, I just don't see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And I think that it's moments like these reporting on our star athletes and our mentors and role models in our community that when they behave in these ways that it really starts to help us shine the light on the issue too. And I'm reflecting back on, you asked Phyllis about a moment when she saw things start to shift. And for me, in my world at Willow, it's been 6 years. And when the Ray Rice situation
yes.
happened, so this was a football player
yep.
who had beat up his girlfriend in the elevator and it was on video. And so the world saw that happen and saw the aftermath of that and the team supporting and not his behavior. And so that really allowed us to open up more conversations, more dialogue about what is okay.
You know, you mentioned Ray Rice, but the in our era, where we saw the incredible power of major sports figures, was O.J. Simpson.
Ah, yes.
And everyone on our staff, I can remember times we just sat there mesmerized, and look at the way the public handled that whole issue.
Well, elaborate on that. How do you think the public handled it?
There was both adulation and cover-up, and he was this major sports figure, and he got away with murder, literally.
And unfortunately, after the trial, a new mantra was given to offenders as they would tell their partners, "I'll OJ you if you don't do what I tell you mm-hmm. to do."
Well, here's what I want to do as we sort of reset and remind you why we're here this hour, because we've got some phone calls to take, Jane Rich, and some emails to read. And we are going to talk about prevalence and why we think our community sees a higher rate of reporting, if that means we see more abuse and violence in our community, or if we see a community that is maybe a little bit more comfortable coming forward and embracing resources, or what our guests think. But we're here because it's been 40 years since the launch of Alternatives for Battered Women, now Willow, and they are marking 40 years with a gala next Friday night. It's November 1st at the Hyatt Regency, and tickets are still available at willowcenterny.org. We are here with Phyllis Korn, who is one of the founders who takes almost no credit and deserves so much for the work that she did in the late 1970s, helping put this on the ground. Vincent Butler is here, a social worker who worked with Alternatives for Battered Women and put together these men's programs that have been so important. And Megan DeChateauvieux, the president and CEO of Willow Now. Let's get our only break of the hour, and we're back to your feedback right after this. Coming up in our second hour, homelessness remains a problem in our community, but often when we talk about homelessness, we don't also talk about mental illness. And yet we know those things are often related. Next hour, a conversation including some personal stories of people who have worked through mental illness, gotten the diagnosis and treatment they needed, and are finding a new way forward. That's next hour. This is Connections, and this is day two of our fall membership campaign. And I briefly want to say hello to producer Megan Mack, who is going to come in here and tell us a little bit about day two on this, what is essentially a short week for us here. We got a long way to go in this short week, Megan.
That is absolutely the case. And you're hearing a lot of activity in the booth. We have many people calling the show today to weigh in on this important discussion we're having about domestic violence. These are the kinds of important conversations we're able to have at length at WXXI. We have 52 minutes to discuss this issue. You can't find that anywhere else in local media. That's possible because of people like you that call 454-6300 and help support your public radio station. Yesterday, we were calling it New Member Monday. Our goal was to sign up 50 new members. If we reach that goal, a generous couple in Irondequoit would invest an extra $2,000 in WXXI. We met that goal. In fact, we got past that goal. And so that inspired a couple in Brighton to offer a similar investment. If we hit 50 new members today, they will invest $2,000 in WXXI. So it's really a team effort. Everyone in the community coming forward, joining together to keep important programming like this on the air. 454-6300 is the number to call. You can also go online at WXXINews.org.
Thank you, Megan Mack. Appreciate that. Here's our first email, and it comes from Steve. Steve Korn. Hi, Mom. I want you to know just how very proud I am of the work you have done on behalf of victims of domestic violence in our community, and I'm also wishing you a very happy on-the-air birthday.
Happy birthday today.
Today is your birthday. Well, Steve says, happy birthday, Mom.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you for that. I appreciate that. Let me work through some of our other feedback. Jane in Rochester on the phone first. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes, Evan. I think, in my opinion, our president is very misogynist and sexist, and he said some things. The one thing that stood out for me was that you could grab women on the street and do as you please with them, as you recall. And it was just so dehumanizing and demeaning to say about anybody. But I was wondering, is there a healthy response to that? I know it's been exposed well, and we know who he is, but is there a healthy response to that other than just getting out and voting with that in mind, how he feels about half of the citizenry? So anyway, thank you very much.
All right, Jane, thank you very much. Megan Chateauvieux, I'll start with you.
I don't know if there can be a direct response, but I do think that I am very optimistic about what I've seen with the Me Too movement. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that actually is our community's direct response to that kind of misogynistic behavior and statements, where we have seen survivors coming forward, sharing their stories, finding strength in that, being together with other survivors and understanding that this is an issue that impacts so many people in our community and throughout the entire country, the world, that there are very few that are immune from this kind of situation. And so I think with the Me Too movement, we have had our response, and it continues to grow.
I have to emphasize that I think the attitude shift characterized by the Me Too movement has been extraordinary. I think it really has moved the needle a bit to have the public acceptance of abuse that may have happened long ago, but women, particularly women, but both men and women, are waking up to the fact that they can, without shame, say, this happened to me too.
But Phyllis, when to Jane's point, and not to make this overly political, I don't think this is a political question. And I think we are starting to see less tolerance just on partisan grounds. And by that, I mean the 90s, you know, Democrats rallied around Bill Clinton in many, many ways. And I don't think that would fly today. And it's a very different situation. Some of the op-eds in The New York Times in the 90s, shaming and smearing the women who made allegations, I don't think that would fly today. And you've seen many prominent Democrats and progressives come out and say that they made mistakes and that they view that differently now. Yet, we do see a president who not only is sort of engaged in tawdry stuff, paying off porn stars, obviously the ugly stuff, but boasting about being able to assault women. In the video of going back decades, the way he would sort of just kind of grope and grab. And what are there? Several dozen accusers who very clearly would have had to coordinate a long list of stories at their own risk to themselves. And there's not a whole lot of consequence for this president. In fact, there are millions of women in this country who are eager to vote for him again.
It boggles the imagination, frankly. Yeah, there are. I can't account for
that's
it.
Not a partisan thing. I mean, if there are Republican women listening, this is not about Republicans, Democrats, whatever. This is, do you think everyone's lying? Do you disbelieve your own eyes in the videos? I'm still sort of baffled by all this.
Yeah. I would say examine your own background too. You know, look for where you have been a victim of abuse in some way, mm-hmm. and think about that carefully before you go to the polls.
What do you think, Vincent?
I think I think it creates an opportunity to have a discussion about, for men, is that acceptable behavior? What if this was your wife, your daughter, your mother that the president was talking about? So it provides an opportunity for reflection and thinking and self-examination, as Phyllis said. We need to take a hard look at that. And what does our culture want to continue to accept, and what does our culture want to eradicate?
Let's go back to phone call. You want to jump back in, Megan? Go ahead.
I was just going to say that I've heard it excused as locker room talk, and then I've also heard many men come forward and say this is not anything what our locker room talk sounds like. We've never experienced that in a locker room. So it's a different kind of culture and a dismissal of the behavior that makes it's the boys will be boys excuse mm-hmm. all over again. And I thought we were done with that decades ago. But here we are.
We tried our best. We're still working on it, and that's yeah. what's still going on today.
Mm-hmm. Before I grab our next phone call, Phyllis wants to make sure the record's clear that we can talk about what happened in July of 1979 with official opening of the doors of Alternatives for Battered Women, but the work had started long before that. Go ahead.
Yeah, it was way back in the late 60s that there were people who were organizing, who were speaking out in the community. And as they gathered momentum, it ultimately became Alternatives for Battered Women. And I should speak to the name change also. Mm-hmm. That really did need to happen because domestic violence occurred in same-sex relationships. It occurred to where the male was the one who was being abused. So it was time for the name to change. It was difficult for me because the organization for so many of us was always ABW. But yes, there was a change.
And that was 5-6 years ago now? Is that right?
Yeah, 2015.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. And there was a reason for the Alternatives for Battered Women name to really be out there and call it what it was and mm-hmm. be very specific and descriptive. And as you say, Phyllis, to recognize that there are so many different kinds of abuse, not just physical. And that it can impact anyone, all genders.
Mm-hmm. All right, so Rich in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, hi, Evan. How are you doing today?
Well, I wish we were talking about a happier story, but go ahead.
Yeah, I've seen abuse up close and personal, but the thing that has really it boggled my mind is it is so insidious. You will see situations where the person who's being abused, say a mother, the children learn to abuse the mother in their own way. And you see this action and it blows your mind. And I wonder if they could speak to maybe seeing that as signs of abuse in homes and maybe that being red flags. But I've actually seen that, and that is painful to see because this child is learning abuse at every level. And it's a sickening thing to see, but I've seen it.
Well, Rich, I appreciate that perspective. Thanks for making the call. You want to add to that, Phyllis?
Yeah, when people ask what causes it or why does it happen, one of the things we've classically answered is it's been learned and learned early and often.
And go ahead, Megan.
I was just going to add that I think we don't often think about the children as the also victims of domestic violence, and we do see this happening in our shelter, in the playroom particularly. We have an opportunity to work with these children when they come to us. We have 30 kids today in the playroom, and they do exhibit these behaviors they've learned at home. It shows domestic violence is a learned behavior and therefore can be changed. And so when we start to work with parents, with the moms typically, sometimes dads, with the children and try to rebuild those family bonds, I think that work is incredibly powerful and important in addressing the trauma the children have experienced. We also have a similar expression. We say that hurt people hurt people.
Mm.
And how do we help them through that?
Mm. Let me get Barbara next on the line. Go ahead, Barbara.
Hi there. A quick hello and a shout out to the wonderful Phyllis and the great Vince. I just was adding to Phyllis's comments. It's a shout out to the Genesee Valley chapter of NOW, who were the folks first started gathering money with the help of none other than Gloria Steinem at a church downtown to gather the first monies that was to later become ABW. Right. And started out another shout out with Margaret Corbin and in a church in Irondequoit that had no safety barriers. I mean, it's an amazing history of yet again women persevering and doing what's right and supporting each other in the face of massive resistance, which unfortunately in, you know, practically 2020 is still happening. But with guys like Vince on the stick there, you know, we're making progress. And, of course, the many, many supportive and dedicated women that are working with it today.
Barbara, thank you for that call. I know they appreciate not only the history, but the shout-outs there. And let's talk about what we know about prevalence there. Because when that work was happening in the 60s, into the 70s, it was more in the shadows. But we now have some data that tells us, Megan DeChateauview, that our reporting in Monroe County and Western New York, we see higher rates here. Why? What's going on?
We do. Yeah, we've seen that in Monroe County, it's twice the statewide rate, excluding the city, New York City. And it's four times the statewide rate in the city of Rochester. So we have incredibly high rates here. It's the highest it's been in the past 7 years in the city of Rochester. We have a couple of potential reasons for that. I think on the optimistic side, I'd like to think that it's because our community has such an incredible coordinated response. We have the consortium of over 50 agencies that all work closely together, including law enforcement, probation, social services, family agencies, supports, and all kinds of ways that people can feel more comfortable coming forward and sharing their story and knowing that the support is there for them. It may also be a sign of the impact of the Me Too movement that more survivors feel comfortable coming forward in the broader landscape and people will believe and respect their stories. And then, of course, there's also the possibility that the numbers are actually on the rise, that the prevalence of domestic violence is actually increasing in our community. I think that we have a really great response to people that come forward, and yet the numbers that we're sharing only include the law enforcement reports. So domestic incident reports that are filed with law enforcement, we have over 5,500 this past year. That's up 12% from the previous year. There's a story to be told there. Our calls to our 24/7 crisis and support hotline at Willow are up 21% year over year. So that's another story to be told. And yet those two outlets, both 911 and law enforcement and Willow's hotline, those are people who are calling who are either in a significant dangerous situation and need the help of law enforcement immediately, or they're calling our hotline because they're ready to make that call and they've, you know, sort of admitted to themselves that they need this support, or they're looking for shelter or counseling or court accompaniment or some kind of program that we offer. But my question really now is, who else is out there that is experiencing this and that doesn't have that channel to come forward through?
What do you think of that prevalence? I mean, are you concerned that we're seeing, Phyllis, an increase in domestic violence, or do you think that we are seeing more utilize the services?
I'd like to see a deeper dig into what's behind those. I could think of all kinds of things. How a law enforcement officer relates to the person who's calling, and how do they mark their records? I mean, there are all kinds of ways in which statistics can creep one way or another, depending on the circumstances. So I'd love to see more investigation of that.
And just a note on how much things have changed in the 40 years. We have an incredible partnership with law enforcement. Actually, the Greece police chief, Pat Fallon, he's a great advocate, and he has instituted a practice within the Greece Police Department where if there is a call for a domestic incident, and the officer comes back without a domestic incident report, he asks why. He does a monthly audit of every domestic call and then asks the officers, what's going on here? Why isn't there a report filed?
His department was one of the ones that was very early and enthusiastic about supporting the work we do.
Mm-hmm. Just looking at the actual data, 2018, 5,553 reports of domestic violence were made to law enforcement agencies in Monroe County. 59% of those reports originated in the city of Rochester. 41% came from surrounding suburbs. The rate of reporting in the city of Rochester is 3.9 times the statewide rate. We're talking about incidents that included 10 domestic violence homicides. 45,990 calls made to Monroe County 911 in 2018 for domestic disputes, and the Willow Center's 24/7 hotline experienced a 21% increase in calls from the previous year. So, you know, certainly the hope is that people are utilizing these services when they need them, not that we're actually seeing the numbers go up. But if you need them, they even have things like a pet shelter. I mean, they have lots of different things that will, well, there's probably a lot of little factors that when people are scared of what it means to come forward, if that means disrupting where you live, what happens? You've addressed a lot of those things over the years, Megan.
We have. We've made a lot of efforts to really listen to survivors and to understand what they need and to be responsive to those needs. So a lot of these new programs that we've developed, they're incredibly innovative. I mean, national pilot models of collaborations, particularly with the work we're doing at the HEAL Collaborative at the URMC. So that's health, education, advocacy, and legal supports, the collaborative. Behind the wall, we have an advocate at the hospital who can go to the emergency room or any hospital bedside and Skype with the judge to submit a remote filing for an order of protection. So if someone's unable to go to the court because of an injury or because of safety reasons, we can be there bedside for them. And that kind of really innovative response to meet survivors where they are, that's our focus now.
And I'm smiling because I remember when we did our first training of nurses at the Strong Memorial Hospital, and our big push to make sure that medical personnel at all levels were aware and responding differently. We feel as if we are a part of why doctors and all other personnel now ask the question, do you feel safe at home?
So as we get ready to wrap, I'm thinking about something Vincent said earlier this hour, which is the work that you had to do to kind of create change in the way men see power structure. I mean, it was a big lift, and it's still going on. At this point, I want to ask all three of you. I'm going to start with Phyllis here. Is there still legislation or a law that you want changed, or is a lot of the work being done now cultural, education, et cetera?
I think there are a lot of tweaks and changes that need to happen to laws. I think that Megan is far closer to the issue and able to say specifically what they are. I'm too far beyond that. But there are changes that are needed, as well as the education of the public at large. Changes in attitude. I think Me Too, the Me Too movement is unbelievable.
Okay. Vincent?
I think also having been retired for a while, push this off onto Megan because she's more attuned to what's happening here and now. But I think there still needs to be some laws that are changed and tweaked and to cover the other avenues of abuse that continue to occur. And we still need to continue to focus on the culture and beliefs and attitudes.
And we've got to be sure that the funding is maintained so that these programs don't disappear.
Okay, mm-hmm. Megan,
it's critically important. So in the topic of legislation, we've had, as I said, 40-plus bills pushed through the New York State legislature signed by the governor on his desk, and we are very grateful for that. Little tweaks to some existing laws, some major ones that have been pushed through that help survivors find safety. One of the significant bills that's passed recently is a bit contentious, and that is about bail reform. And so, while we fully support the intentions behind that I would just ask that there be a carve-out made for domestic violence survivors and for offenders to have better offender accountability with the bail reform bill. The other piece, as we've had these major changes at the state level, the federal level continues to lag behind, so we still do not have the passage of the Violence Against Women Act, the reauthorization this year. It's been reauthorized with bipartisan support for decades. Louise Slaughter was a big lead on that as well. Amazing work that she did, and Joe Morelli has been very helpful in pushing it through Congress, and yet the Senate has yet to take action. So at the federal level, we are really striving for VAWA to be reauthorized again. This, the legislative level, the agency level, the collaborative level, there are so many people that are doing so many great things to push this mission forward and to support survivors and hold offenders accountable. And I want to take an opportunity, as we have these listeners who may be from all walks of life, to say that it takes the entire community and that you may be the first person that a survivor discloses to and shares their story with. And so knowing how to respond in an appropriate way, how to recognize the red flags that someone might be seeing, and how to respond to them and how to refer them to the right resource in the community, those are critical. So especially if you're a bank teller or a hairstylist or a coach or a parent, teens are coming forward with these, young teens are coming forward with abusive situations. So knowing how to respond to that, we have tools on our website. You can take a look at things to say. We actually suggest some words to use, things to say and ways to respond.
The website, if you want those tools, or if you want information on Willow's 40th anniversary gala, the website is willowcenterny.org. And that gala is next Friday, November 1st at the Hyatt. And I'll see you there, too. I'll be glad to be there with the team that has been doing this phenomenal work. So, Phyllis, whether you want it or not, you get a lot of the credit. And this community is grateful for the work that you have done. Thank you for that. And thank you for sharing your story this hour.
Thank you.
Vincent Butler, you too, man. You get great work. Phenomenal, important, hard work, especially at a time where the culture was in a very different place. Thank you. Thank you for the work you've done.
Thank you.
And Megan Chateauvieux, we'll see you too next Friday.
Thank you.
And we'll see you at Willow as well, the president and CEO of Willow Domestic Violence Center. Short break, more connections coming up.